I got it.
Blog Talk Radio. All too often these days, the factory whistle is falling silent in America. But there is a way to get American workers back to work. Start buying more American-made products. Now,
Welcome to the UAW Factory Whistle Show. Scott, Jimmy, it's all yours.
Hi, Jim.
Hey, guys. What's going on? What's going on, Scott?
Not a whole lot. Just trying to make sense of what's going on in the world today. That's all.
I hear you. Did you have a union meeting today?
No. We won't have a union meeting for, I think, 2 more weeks.
We had one today. You guys out there, pay attention and see if you guys got something going on with your bylaws. I don't want to start nothing yet, but there was some crap said about we're being required to change our bylaws, so listen to that.
That could be interesting. Yeah.
It's going to be, but I don't want to start it until I hear it in other places, you know.
Right, right.
So that being said, I hope everybody had a good one.
It's been 6 years, 7 years since they've changed our bylaws. And, yeah, I hope everybody had a good holiday, a happy Easter, and got to enjoy time with your family and a couple extra days off that were negotiated in our behalf. And a few things we got to pick up. That came at a price, too. I always tell everybody that extra day off came at a price. So I can be wrong.
Nope, you're right.
You know what I mean? It cost you something somewhere. It did. But anyways, got anybody calling in, if you want to join the show or have a question or a comment, please press 1, number 1, number uno on your keypad, and we will get you on the show. Anyway, so what's all happened last week? I see where some people got a little disgruntled in South Korea. And
yep.
They ransacked the CEO's office. I guess they were withholding a bonus, I believe, on their behalf. And, I see this, and the first person that comes to my mind is Brian Keller. I don't know why, but it is. You know what I mean?
Yeah, I thought about that, too. We know it wasn't Rocket Man. That's for damn sure.
No. This is South Korea.
That's what I mean. We know it wasn't Rocket Man.
So, when they talked, General Motors, local subsidiary, and their labor union wanted to reach a wage deal swiftly after their automaker failed to make their full bonus payment. So it was a violent protest, and yes, they did ransack GM's executive offices. So General Motors better hope that the people in Colombia and some of these other countries don't see this and, you know, follow suit. Just an observation, I guess. So, anyway, what else went on this last week? I mean, there's been a couple of weeks we've missed, so there's been a few things that have come up and down. I noticed that the defense that the FCA Chrysler, you know, the executive lied to the grand jury about conspiracy. So I think that's number 5 now officially in the books. And he will be doing jail time. Michael Brown was his name, by the way. And he's the seventh person charged in a Whiting corruption investigation. But he pled guilty. He covered conspiracy designed to wring concessions from the United Auto Workers that favored the automaker. Okay, so this is a Detroit News article wrote by Robert Snell, but I just want to point that out. That he did plead guilty, and he pled guilty to covering up a conspiracy designed to wring the concessions from the United Auto Workers that favored the automaker. Say it again. Concessions from the UAW that favored the automaker. So, you know, if you put these pieces together a little bit, you can see how this is going to carry over. We knew that there was a reason where Chrysler went first. And, I mean, it's getting to be more and more evident. It's very clear, in my opinion anyway, of what's happening. I don't think they're done.
Now, Scott, was this Norwood's management counterpart or Norwood's top AA?
That one, I don't know.
I'm almost thinking this guy was Norwood's management counterpart because if I read right, wasn't he facing 5 years and he made a plea deal down to two?
You know,
I've had so many of them, I'm getting confused.
Well, yeah, because there's so many people involved in this whole thing. I mean, like I said, you know, even Richard said it, this is going to take a while to sort this out because they're going through receipts. They're figuring who was doing what with who and when and why and where. And, you know, it's all just a big puzzle right now.
Yeah, I don't know why I was thinking this was Norwood's management counterpart because, as we all know, there's one union and one management for every one of them type of ordeals like that.
Right. He was director in Fiat Chrysler Employee Relations Department that has since left the company, of course. So, yeah, you're right. I would think that would probably be close to Norwood's counter. Like I said, he was the director in the Employee Relations Department. So,
right,
we refer to that as labor relations, and that's usually your counterpart across the VP.
Right. So he's the one that wanted to throw the $30,000 party.
You know, I find it interesting that Marcioni has come out, when he was questioned by the federal investigators, said that the alleged conspiracy had nothing whatsoever to do with the collective bargaining process. So him and Dennis Williams are on the same page with that. And I just my opinion, but I would like to see them both walked out in handcuffs. And see that on the front page of the Free Press. So he said, alleged. Well, it can't be alleged anymore if one of his management people has pled guilty to this charge. So no, now that makes that no longer alleged, but it actually happened, correct?
Yeah, Scott, let me get Paul's on. Let me get Paul up
there.
Paul, you're on.
Well, doesn't a lot of the real bargaining really take place before the actual official bargaining happens? They get together over their wine and their beer, and they discuss management's problems, how they need more productivity and need to cut costs and all that garbage. I mean, there isn't a lot of the actual stage set long before they go to the table that they've kind of agreed on some issues before that even happens. So, you know, if that's the case, then The guy from Chrysler is just being a bag of wind.
Right. Mr. Danzen has said that. He said that numerous times in the past.
Yep.
That once you finish up negotiations on a national agreement, they usually take just a little bit of time off, and they always start working on the next one.
Yeah. I mean, management goes to the bargaining table. They have about 50 things they want the union to give them, and they walk away with 25 of them, and they get ready to take the other 25 away from the membership in the next round of bargaining.
Oh, I agree with that. I believe the things they didn't get this time, they will try to achieve on the next time. And, if you keep just whittling away at a piece of wood, eventually you're not going to have no wood left. You know what I mean?
Scott?
Yeah.
Hold on. I think we got Mr. Danjan right here. Let me get him on. Dick, is that you?
Hello.
That is.
Hello.
Hello.
Scott, Jim, Paul, you're digging a hole that you know nothing about. Absolutely
okay.
Nothing.
Please explain.
Mr. Brown, who was the management guy, was the co-director of the National Training Center at Chrysler, was partnered up with another guy named Kevin. I don't remember his last name, but Kevin just betrayed everybody so he'd get a lighter sentence. The way those training centers are structured is you have the vice president of the UAW department partnered up with the director of industrial relations of the corporation. Norwood Jewell's partner was the Italian guy Iacobelli. They were the co-chairs of the National Executive Board of the Chrysler Training Center. Now, as CEOs, they obviously had people who ran those organizations day to day. That was this management guy named Brown and the union guy named Kevin. I don't remember his last name. So Kevin and Brown ran the center day to day. Only monthly did Norwood and come in, and they would have a national joint executive board meeting. There is no way in hell that Norwood and Iacobelli being the guy that said I stole $405 million, they were partnered up together. Norwood has currently been indicted. Now, the only way for him to lessen his sentence is to tell it. He used the street vernacular to get a lighter sentence. We don't know what Norwood has told the FBI, not about what's below him, but what's above him. That being Dennis Williams and Sergio Marchionne. That's what
right.
The FBI is doing. They start at the lowest level of corruption, and they work their way up the ladder, getting those people to betray the people above them. It's Norwood's time now to betray everybody. And the only people Norwood's got to betray is Dennis Williams. You guys need to stop this stuff. You don't know what the hell you're talking about. If you don't know, don't talk about it.
Dick?
Because you're telling people stuff that they can't understand, and they run off, and they start yapping at each other about what they think all this stuff means. This is an organizational structure the same as the org chart at Chrysler, the org chart at General Motors. They started at the bottom, the FBI, and they've worked their way up through the organizational structure of the National Training Center at Chrysler, with lower-level people, lower-level, upper-upper. Suddenly we get to Norwood's administrative assistant, and she tells it all about Norwood. Now, the only way for Norwood to get out from under, or at least to minimize what he's going to get involved in, is for Norwood to betray the guy above him. And that guy is Dennis Williams. Now, this is going to happen at GM, and it will happen at Ford.
This guy is great.
This is standard criminal investigation process. This is not unique to the UAW GM. This is standard criminal corporate corruption investigative process. This will play itself out. The man on the hot seat now is Norwood Jewell. Does he want to not become a 1920s movies rat and betray the guy above him and take his punishment? Or does he want to betray the guy above him and get the minimum sentence that he could get? This is not complicated stuff. Brown, the guy that was in the news this week, is the management guy who was partnered up with this other guy named Kevin. I can't remember his last name. And they were the day-to-day managers of the National Training Center. Those two guys, in terms of day-to-day management, did not know what was going on. The FBI knows this. They're just busy making deals. Now, to somebody like you folks looking from the outside in, wow, this means this and this means that. No, it doesn't. It means that they are progressing up. They got the people below the two co-directors on day-to-day management. And that was this woman named Johnson and Varel King, who worked for Norwood. These two women bought him the shotgun, but never mind the shotgun. So they got those two women. And they've also got the people on the management side. They're working their way up the ladder to the top of the UAW, not Chrysler. We know that Bob King, a little over 18 months ago, went to the Chrysler National Training Center with two other people, according to the Detroit News. At the time, he was president, but who was the financial secretary treasurer? Dennis Williams. And who was the other person? Now, in their indictment process, if you read the court documents, the FBI has identified 12 people, and they've only gave them a number, UAW number 3, UAW number 11. If you read the court documents, which none of you bother doing, what the hell, why should you do that? You may find out what's going on. There are 11 people up that food chain, and all they have is not names, but number. The names manifest themselves when suddenly they say, oh, we've indicted this guy. Now, there is a court document seeking a warrant to search Norwood's home, which is on the internet, which I've read. And there are other court documents, one with this management guy, Brown. It's all out there to read. And none of you read anything. Dick,
well,
this is a typical, like a homicide investigation. They're looking for ultimately the ultimate criminal here. Now, in an organizational investigation like this, the ultimate criminal is obviously the two people who are the titular heads of both sides. And in the case of Chrysler, that is Sergio Marchionne, and that is Dennis Williams. Hell, they got Norwood nailed. Why aren't they stopping? They're not stopping because they want to get to the titular head of both organizations. This is not complex stuff. It's not like it happened the first time, and oh, my God, oh, my God. This is standard stuff. Everybody needs to calm down and quit looking for the ultimate bad guy. The ultimate bad guy will be manifested when the FBI concludes its investigation. This is still ongoing. The other thing is, what nobody seems to understand, I'm going to give you one fact that's never been in the papers before. From 2009, at the end of the bankruptcy, to last year, General Motors has given the UAW $333 million in joint fund reimbursed staff expense. I'm not going to go into it any more than that. I have a mind to call the FBI myself on this one. $333 million since the bankruptcy is something called joint fund reimbursement. None of you have heard of that. There's not a reporter anywhere who knows about it. And I'm just telling you about it. That's going to be another investigation. So anyway, coming back to this thing is playing itself out. Quit assuming things. Let it play itself out. It's coming to a conclusion. The conclusion will be when Norwood cops a plea, it'll be because he betrayed who? I think you
Dennis
all
Williams.
Answer that question for yourself.
Right.
Don't get all assumed about Cindy Estrada. She's kind of standing because none of you know the real history of Cindy Estrada. I guarantee you there's not anybody listening to me who knows the real history of Cindy Estrada and how she got where she is.
It has well, I don't know anybody that said her name. That's the first time that name come out.
It has to do with nepotism.
Hey,
Frank White?
Yep.
Dick, thanks for that explanation. I don't know anything about what goes on in the training center. All I was saying was, at least from my understanding, management and union counterparts build relationships far before they go into the bargaining, and management's telling the union all about all their problems, and they're setting them up to take stuff away from us long before we go into bargaining.
Now, wait a minute, Paul. Let me explain something to you. In joint programs, typically, and in particularly in Saturn Corporation, every management person had a union counterpart.
Right.
Foreman, the general foreman, the superintendent, the vice president of manufacturing, the vice president of marketing, they all had union counterparts. When I was ordered by Steve Jokic to go be assigned to Saturn Corporation, as the international representative to Saturn. My partner was the president of the corporation. Theoretically, there was nothing he was supposed to be doing that I was not involved in. Theoretically.
Right.
Skip LaFoe had a major problem with me coming to Saturn. And he told Jack Smith, the CEO of General Motors, when Steve called Jack Smith and said, Dick Danton is going to be our representative of Saturn. The president of Saturn told the CEO of GM, if you let Steve assign Dick Danton to Saturn, he'll be the death of the corporation. This is a true story. I didn't give a shit about all that. I knew Skip LaFoe for 10 years. And I was an outspoken critic of Saturn when they first announced Saturn. 3 years, 4 years before they even broke ground down there, I was a critic of Saturn. I said, it's all bullshit. And then I was ordered by Jokic to go to Saturn and be the partner of the president of the corporation, who said to his boss, the Roger Smith of GM, if you let Steve assign him, he'll be the death of the corporation. Now, you guys don't understand, when we make major significant moves, whether they're going to say, they'll call Steve Jokic up and say, we're going to put this person in charge of this plant. How do you feel about that? Or Steve calls up and says, I'm sending that fucking Danton down to Spring Hill. And there's nothing you can say that's going to stop me from doing that. So those are the two ends of that extreme. They exchange assignments between these corporations and the union. We're gonna put Paul in charge of General Motors metal stamping. How do you guys feel about that? Well, we don't like Paul. Now it depends on how strongly the union wants Paul to go to be in charge of metal stamping. People don't understand that this has been going on for 50 years. We don't just unilaterally and arbitrarily grab Dick Danton by the top of his ears and drop him into Saturn. We call up Saturn. We call up General Motors to say, Dick is coming to Saturn. The CEO of GM calls up the plant manager, the president of Saturn, and says, the UAW has told me that Dick is going to be assigned to Saturn. The president of Saturn says, holy shit, he'll fucking be the end of the corporation. Well, why would Skip say that? What is it that I would be bringing to Saturn that's going to destroy the company? Now, I'm not going to get into all the psychiatric explanations of all of that shit to you. But I'm saying we have been doing that for 50 years with GM. Now, along comes joint programs. All joint programs say typically is that in a joint program, management people will have a union partner. Now, there's not a lot of language. If you go on the internet and look at local agreements and look for language that says, oh, okay, Paul is going to be assigned to GMS, the Global Manufacturing System. So who's going to be his partner? They astutely avoid any language talking about the fact that everybody in a joint program has got a management partner. They don't want the world to know that that's what's going on. A lot of times because we appoint somebody at a local union to be the GMS guy, and he's a fucking moron. He got the job because of politics. And GMS is extremely important to General Motors. So that means the guy that they assigned to be the head GMS guy in a given plant has to handle Paul. We know Paul doesn't know anything, and we don't want to teach him anything. All we got to keep him is dumb, fat, and happy, which is what they did at Chrysler with the credit cards. We'll give these people credit cards and keep them dumb, fat, and happy. Hell, go buy yourself a new car. We don't give a shit. That's the way this shit works if the union people don't understand their role, which is defined in the UAW Constitution. You are not there, if you pay union dues, to get along with management. You are there to be adversarial in the interest of your membership, not to be management's buddy.
Well said, Dick. How about a round of applause?
All I am saying is this.
Yeah.
These people in these joint programs have lost their way. And now we have this unique guy in General Motors, in a current GM agreement, who's a document 46 person, who has a separate document 46 status, apart from the other document 46 people, that says he will do GMS. And these guys have become the princes of the hourly workforce. They're all sitting out there at M59 and I-75 in the old human resource building, which we sold to Chrysler for $1, and now GM is back in that building. They're not in the plant every day, these Doc 46 people who are appointed, and that is bullshit. These people should all be elected. There should be nobody. I don't care. Every goddamn clipboarder in a GM plant should not be allowed to be appointed. They should be elected. If they're not elected, then fuck them. Let them go back to work. But if you got a clipboarder running around there like a team leader telling you what to do, and he's not elected, you have the right to tell him to go to hell in a handbag. It's all nonsense. They have conned the UAW in letting them appoint these team leaders and letting them appoint these people, these clipboarders, to all these activities, and the people in the plant don't know who they are, they don't know what they're doing, and they're having enormous control over their work life, and they do not represent you. Nobody who is appointed represents you. Get that in your heads, everybody who's listening. Appointed local joint people do not represent you, not legally, not contractually. You do not have to listen to them. They are management's donkeys. All right, I'm done. I didn't mean to get off into this, but I got on a show about 7 o'clock, and I found myself in the middle of, holy cow, the show's going on. Well, who are these guys? What show is this?
Well, Dick, you're a great educator. That's what we actually need.
All right, anyway, whatever the purpose of the show is, you guys need to calm down about what the FBI is doing. It's a progressive ladder. It's one step, one rung at a time to the top of the organization. Let the FBI do their work. Let them turn their witnesses in their own self-preservation. We'll see what that is, but understand that. Everybody from below Norwood has betrayed the person they worked with so far. That's why this thing is progressing. Now it's Norwood's turn, in his own self-preservation, to betray the guy on top of him. All right, without any comment about that, I have no animus. Animus means any negative feelings toward Norwood. He's got to do that in his own self-preservation. Let that game play itself out. Quit thinking you know what's going on. I've told you what's going on. The guy below betrays the guy above. And once that happens, then the guy above betrays the guy above him. It's that simple. It's like a ladder. There's nothing complicated here. This is self-preservation. Keep me out of jail. Minimize my fine. What do you want to know? I'll tell you everything. That's human nature. Whether it's Norwood Jewell or somebody in the federal government, that's the way these things work.
Like the Nuremberg War trials, where the defense was, my boss told me to do it.
Whatever model you want to use, whatever metaphor you want to use. Now, the next thing facing the workers in the plant, though, is something significant happened down in Spring Hill, Tennessee, at Local 1853. They just negotiated and ratified a local agreement in Local 1853. Now, this is very, very significant for everybody listening to this show.
Because
local agreements going back 30 years ago, once the national agreement was negotiated, then you started local negotiations. Because all the local agreement is how the language in the national agreement plays out at your local site. Around 1979 to 81, the UAW and the corporation changed that. And they told these plant chairmen at the sub-councils and at the GM council, get your local union agreement negotiated before the start of national negotiations. And they were running contests among these chairmen through the servicing rep to get the local agreement negotiated before the national agreement was ratified. That is absolutely insane. How can you negotiate a local agreement that says this is what the language in the national agreement means here at Local 598 when the contract hasn't been ratified? And because these people were manipulated in the sub-councils and the GM council or the Ford council and their sub-councils, these chairmen who wanted staff jobs said, okay, and a servicing rep, like I was, my job is to go out and say, hey, Paul Baxter, you're the chairman here. Listen, brother, if you want a staff job, get your local agreement negotiated before the commencement of the national contract. Now, I don't need to tell Paul Baxter anything more than that, do I? You'll sell your mother to get a staff job, won't you? So Paul Baxter goes out there, and the corporation, who's part of this strategy agreed to with the UAW, says, yeah. And so Paul Baxter wanders into the personnel director's office and says, hey, Dick Danjan, should we start negotiations now? Personnel director says, hey, yeah, Paul, let's get her done. But he doesn't tell you that he knows what you've been told. So you negotiate a contract to operationalize the national agreement, which hasn't been negotiated yet, before it happens. And so there was this thing for two contract years in a row where these chairmen were negotiating these local agreements about operating a national agreement that nobody knew what it said. And that is part of the process of why we're so screwed up in these plants today. And I'm not going to go into much more detail. I'm going to make that broad brush statement. And if anybody wants a long 2-hour conversation of how that works, that's fine. I'll be happy to do that, but not on this show. So, a national agreement gets negotiated, the reason for the local agreement is so you read the national agreement and say, well, this is what it means here at the Flint truck plant. So how the hell can you do that before they've even negotiated the national agreement? So that whole, the whole purpose of the local agreement is gone now. It was a handbook for applying the national agreement at a local. Now we don't do that anymore. And now if you look at page 8 of the highlights of the 2015 UAW-GM agreement, you'll find out why. Because your national agreement is a living agreement now. And if somebody, and it says right there in the highlights, if there is something that exists at a local union level, the UAW-GM Council at that level can mitigate, modify, add to, or delete any language in the national or local agreement they choose to. It's right there in black and white. Problem is, nobody bothered to read it. You don't have any language in the national agreement that you can take to the bank. It's all subject to mitigation, modification, removal, or addition to. It's all there. Nobody read it. I don't blame anybody. How would anybody who's not a contract mechanic even begin to understand what those words mean? I don't fault people, but the International Union takes advantage of that. You folks have no idea. You get that black book with 720-some-odd pages, and you think this is it. It is not it. It's whatever anybody wants it to be. All 700-and-some pages. That's what we have come to. Now, there's no reporters, no people who write books, and I know a lot of newspaper reporters. I've not even tried to call them up when that contract was ratified in 2015 and say, here's the real story, because they're just a bunch of morons anyway. They're looking for lines that bleed, that cause blood. All I can say is I feel so sorry for the people who are in the plant. I don't mean the temps. I don't mean the tier two. I mean guys like you who are tier one workers who don't understand that those words are sitting on a bed of quicksand in that agreement. And welcome to today's world. So who do I tell this to? Nobody's going to believe it because they don't have enough knowledge to understand it. So all this talk on these shows like this and Leroy's show and all that other crap, if you don't understand this stuff, shut up. Until you do. That contract is not like Moses' tablets carved in stone. It's rice paper looking for a rainstorm. And our UAW union has become the subservient servant of the corporations. Now, I read a lot of stuff every day on the internet where people say, oh, the UAW and unions are blah, blah. But this is what has really happened. This is what's going on. Mary Barr can pick up the phone to Dennis Williams and say, you know that language in paragraph 17? We need to fix it to the advantage of the corporation. And Dennis Williams says, yes, ma'am. Can I prove it? No. Because when they do fix it, it's done with something called a Memorandum of Understanding, an MOU. And you will never see them. You can't FOIA request them. But it's written down that that ain't what the language says. I know Jim tells me the International Rep came to our union meeting and says, well, the UAW agreed to it. Well, that's what the UAW agreed to means. You have no idea how fragile our representation is in terms of taking on the corporation for 2.5 hours of dues every month. And it is a purposeful, conscious relationship that Dennis Williams and whoever's going to be the next president will have with these corporations. All right. I spent 3 hours on the phone today with a consultant friend of mine. I'm about talked out. So you guys go back to whatever the hell you were talking about.
Well, when you came on, I was talking about Chrysler. I wasn't trying to be making this bigger than what it is. All I was saying was that the fellow had pled guilty to something that Marcioni had said wasn't so. That's
what fellow
awesome.
Are
I know
you
this
talking
is play
about,
out.
Scott? Are you talking about Brown?
Yeah.
Brown is
and
the management guy who is the partner of the union guy, Kevin, and they were
Keith.
The day-to-day managers of the NTC.
Keith Mickens. Keith.
What?
Keith. His name is Keith Mickens.
Right, okay. So Keith was the union co-director, day-to-day manager of the NTC
right.
with the guy Brown. All right?
Right.
You know about Brown, right? The guy
yeah.
that just was indicted this week. I've got his
yeah.
court document. I've read that.
Right.
Now, but those guys are only the day-to-day managers. The people who are in charge of the NTC is Norwood and Iacobelli.
Right.
Now, the FBI indicted Iacobelli weeks ago. So nobody understands the way the FBI did that. The timing says, well, what did Norwood have to do with anything? He was the bedmate of Iacobelli.
Right.
And once a month, they would go to the NTC, the two of them, and they would have a board of directors meeting of the Joint Training Center. They were the two titular heads. Norwood and Iacobelli. General
right.
Hollifield and Iacobelli. That's why when Hollifield died and Norwood became vice president of GM, Iacobelli was there. And that's what that $30,000 party was about out at the NTC in Warren, Michigan. Not on Jefferson Avenue, but the world-class manufacturing building over there in Warren. Jimmy, what mile road is that where that world-class manufacturing building is on Warren? What street is that? 9 mile and what? Are you sleepy,
Uh-oh.
Mattis?
Oh
no, I'm right here.
All right, what is that?
9 miles.
That building that you and I drove by and I pointed out to you, that's on 9 mile and what?
Are you sure it was 9 mile? I was thinking it was 10 mile between Ryan and Mound, but you could be right.
Okay, so anyway, it's in Warren, on 10 mile between Ryan and what's the other road, Jim?
Mound Road.
Between and Mound, because it's near a pizza place that Jimmy and I like. called Louis, but that's another story.
What?
In any event, what they have done now is Chrysler has sold the National Training Center building on Jefferson Avenue between Solidarity House and the Walker Road GM CHR. And they have moved that whole operation of the NTC into this world-class manufacturing building on 10 Mile Road between Ryan and Mound now. So they've sold the building itself. And that's indicative, symbolically, that it's gone, it's all cleaned up. It's not gone and it's all cleaned up. And John Barbarossa, who's been on this show, who works for Chrysler, who apparently has something to do with world-class manufacturing, has been in that building. And he told Jim and I that that building is so huge. It's an old supplier plant. It is so huge that they put the National Training Center in there, which was in a six-story building on Jefferson Avenue in downtown Detroit, in that building with tons of rooms still with nothing in it. This whole business now of these joint activities and the untraceability of the money. In 2007, we stopped funding Ford, GM, and Chrysler joint activities with 19 cents per hour per worker, plus an overtime penalty of $1.25 to $5 per hour. We've eliminated the funding schedule, and the corporations will make money available to the union from time to time as needed. So there's no more transparency or accountability as to how much money these three companies are giving the damn UAW for these joint programs and God knows for what else. The corruption is, there's a word called miasma. It is miasmic. Miasma means putrid, stinky, rotten, unredeemable. And that's what joint funding is now. Not to mention the fact of this $333 million that the UAW has received just for joint fund international staff reimbursement in GM alone. So whatever number of people in Ford, GM, and Chrysler are assigned to their training centers, yes, they work for the UAW and they're paid by the UAW, but the total cost of their remuneration is refunded back to the UAW by Ford, GM, and Chrysler. I don't know what the hell the Department of Labor is, doesn't know this, or the IRS. But apparently they're looking the other way on this. And I'm just talking about $333 million from GM alone. You gotta be talking between the bankruptcy period and now, probably $1 billion has gone into the coffers of the UAW to pay for the wages, pensions, benefits, life insurance, expense account money spent to the UAW, that number has got to be somewhere around $1 billion now. I mean, the UAW is like an investment firm. It's not a union. You got that many people. I mean, if I had a Chrysler and a GM and a Ford contract, I could look at the list of names of the people in the back of that contract, and I have a way to tell you how many of those people actually are reps that are joint fund reimbursement. Why would Chrysler, Ford, or GM reimburse the UAW for people assigned to joint training programs? They're international reps and they're paid by the UAW. Oh, no. Some clever guy, and his name is Gary Jones, as far as I'm concerned, who's about to become your new president, came up with this business of joint fund reimbursed. Every international rep that's working in all these training centers that's paid by the UAW, the UAW gets the total cost of their employment paid back by the companies. You have no idea the scale of corruption that's going on here with huge amounts of money. I don't fault the guys who are assigned to the joint programs. I mean, they may or may not know the joint fund reimbursed. Hell, when Yogesh ordered me back to Saturn in 1996, I didn't realize that any international representative had anything to do with Saturn was joint fund reimbursed. I found out about 2 weeks later from a friend of mine down there, in management, by the way. So the total cost of me flying down to Spring Hill every Monday morning at 5:30 in the morning, flying back on Thursday, my per diem, my total expenses, the total cost of me being an international rep once a month was reimbursed back to the UAW by Saturn Corporation. People don't understand how deep this crap goes. Anyway, General Motors, I saw an article in the paper today that GM is dropping the Cruze and the Impala. Did anybody see that article?
Yep. And Ford's dropping the Fiesta and the...
I know about that. I want to know who read... Now, I found that article about 2 hours ago. I was on the phone for 3 hours this afternoon coming into the show. I got something to eat, and I thought, oh, shit, here comes the show. And I thought I'd do a last-minute check, and it said GM is dropping the Impala. Now, they're dropping the Impala, the Cruze, and one other car, right?
Yes.
Well, they're dropping the Sonic. They're dropping the Sonic.
Right.
Well, you know, what a wonderful company to work for. Mary Barra has shut down operations in South Africa, in Germany with Opel, in France, in England. She shut down just about all her foreign operations, India, except in China. So you are looking at, and now if they're doing what Marchionne did 2 years ago, they are out of the goddamn car business. You all need to think hard about who the hell you work for. And I don't mean 598 makes trucks. I mean what's going to be left, because there was an article by a guy named Peter DiLorenzo called The Auto Extremist who said, it looks like Ford and GM are simply going to want to be in a truck business because that's where the high profit margins are.
Right.
I got to tell you, that does not bode well for anybody who's listening to this show.
No. No.
Well, it doesn't bode very well because it's, you know, if some young person wants a new car and they can't get one from the big three, they're going to go to our competitors, and then if they're satisfied with that car, when they can afford a $40,000 truck, they're going to buy it from our competitors.
There are no fucking $40,000 trucks anymore, Paul. But go ahead.
Well, my point is just that if they're satisfied with, say, a Toyota automobile, when it comes time to buy the a truck, they're most likely going to buy a Toyota. They're not going to buy one from General Motors.
I think the marketing people at Ford, GM, and Chrysler are doing a huge disservice to their organizations because Toyota is now saying, okay, if these assholes think they're going to make all this money, we're going to do with them what we did with cars. And Toyota now has got a strategy to get into the truck market big time. And Volkswagen has now announced they're going to make a pickup truck.
Right.
And so, okay, fine. That's fine. Hell, there's only 52,000 people in GM. There's 52,000 in Ford. And there's about 41,000 in Chrysler. And now we're going to stop making cars. We're going to become a I don't know what kind of car companies. Because General Motors is number four in global production now. And my guess is before this word is this year is out, they're going to be less than number four. But General Motors doesn't care. All they want to do is do stock buybacks, pay dividends, and have a 10% profit margin. Whether they're selling ice cream cones, I don't think Mary Barr cares if she's selling cars or ice cream cones. And that is a threat to our members because she doesn't care what business she's in as long as she makes a 10% margin.
Well, they're one generation away from having very few customers if they get rid of car production.
Well, I don't know what you base that statement on. All I'm saying is this. She's made a decision. She's only going to go with high-margin vehicles. So we can take a $46,000 Silverado and call it a Silverado Outback or whatever it is and get another $20,000 for the same damn truck. So labor cost has become incalculable anymore. If you got two four-wheel drive quad cab pickups coming down the line, and one of them says Silverado, and the other one says Outback or whatever that model is, and it's $20,000 more to buy a damn thing, what's the labor cost? If you got a GMC quad cab, four-wheel drive coming down the line in Schindeldecker's plant, and suddenly it becomes a Denali, it's $30,000 more. How much more labor went into that truck? Literally not much more at all. And that's how they're making their 10% margin. And on the other hand, they're squeezing Harry Hubcap to the teams saying, look, there's nine of you in the team. There's been nine of you here for almost 11 months now. You got to figure out a way to do the same work with eight of you. And the dumbasses do it because they don't know any better.
And
the team leaders get all this special training to make sacrificial lambs out of their union brothers and sisters. That's the world now.
Well,
and General Motors doesn't care where it ranks. All they care about is 1.5 billion shares of stock, how many they can keep buying back. When the UAW Viva sold a block of its stock, General Motors said they were going to buy 40 million shares of that as a stock buyback. They could increase the price of their stock. But what the hell business is General Motors in? It sure as hell ain't in a motor vehicle business.
No, no.
And then we have to look at the people who populate these plants and say, does anybody care about these human beings at all? And the answer is, fuck no. They're, you are not viewed as human beings with lives, with families. We've got alternative work schedules that totally destroy your family lives.
Your health.
We got temporary workers out there with a matrix in the back of the GM agreement that says, here's a 5-year progression for a temporary worker to get from entry level pay to top pay. That is insane. I'm a temporary worker and you're giving me a 5-year wage progression. And I can be fired any day if my shoelace ain't tied.
Right.
I mean, the insanity of Dennis Williams and his contract negotiations is just that. Insane. I mean, these temporary workers are out there because they can't make $15, $16, $17 an hour anywhere out there. So they come in these plants, and then they find themselves in a 5-year progression. A progression for temporary workers. Think about that. It's an oxymoron. And yet, it's considered normal now. There's no rational way to think about what's going on in these Detroit 3 plants under these contracts negotiated by these fools that populate Solidarity House. And they're not fools. They're self-serving people who are using their positions to their own advantage and to keep the corporation alive, because as I said, if in Ford, GM, and Chrysler, you've got, let's see, 150 people who you hired on your staff collectively, and not once a month, you get completely reimbursed for the wages and benefits you paid these guys. It's a revenue stream. So the idea being is the more people we got in joint programs, the more money we make. We paid those guys. Now we get all that money back. It's like they never were to our balance sheet. And then there's a whole other discussion you could have about the strike fund and the dues increase. But nobody's really having them. I look at Facebook pages every morning. There's one thread out there about, well, you know, there's going to be a big argument about whether we keep the 2.5-hour dues or whether we go back to 2 hours. That's not the argument. The argument is going back to the original language of the Constitution that says no money in the strike fund or its interest can be used for anything but paying strike benefits. 2 years from now, you would see the strike fund up close to $800 million. But that money would be bringing a hole in the international's pocket because they couldn't touch it to use it for anything else like they do now, taking 100% of the interest off the strike fund to use to run the union itself, to pay the light bills of Solidarity House. That's what needs to be fixed on a strike fund. Not an argument about whether we pay an extra half hour dues or not. It's what are you doing with that money? What are you doing with the interest? 100% of the interest on a strike fund is skimmed like a Las Vegas Mafia 1960s skim off the top. 25% goes into something called the emergency fund, in the general fund, and the other 75% goes into a slush fund for the IEB to do whatever the hell they want with it. These These are the things that need to be fixed. The argument that some folks are, well, we're going to do a resolution, no more half-hour dues. Screw that. It's still let 100% of the interest on $600 million go to where? To who? To do what? Stop that shit.
Right.
Dick,
the
still got to get people
so
elected.
Corrupt. That it's impossible to talk about it anymore.
We have to get people elected who are not corrupt, who care about what's going on, who don't want to move into a position just to benefit themselves. At the 2006 Constitutional Convention, I was one of three people that spoke out against taking money out of the strike fund. I stated that my membership went on strike for, you know, 54 days in 1998, and I knew what a strike fund was for. It was supposed to be a weapon against corporate management, and if we took money out of that strike fund, it was going to be telling the corporation we didn't intend to use it. And, but the thing is, you know, it was my first convention. I hate public speaking, but I hate corruption more than I fear public speaking. And the thing is, that's a convention full of people who are trained in public speaking, and they just sit there on their hands and say nothing. It's a bunch of crap.
They don't understand, Paul. It is so complex. In a way, it's so complex that it's not complex. When they changed the language of the strike fund and said, we're changing the name of the strike fund, the strike and defense fund, that opened up the floodgates to just scoop up 5-gallon buckets, $100 bills out of the strike fund to do whatever the International Union wanted to do with it.
Yeah.
We've got, it's not a matter of the amount of dues. It's a matter of keeping the money that goes into the strike fund and the money that the strike fund earns to stay in the strike fund only to be used to pay for strike reimbursement.
Right.
That is the position. Now, how do you explain that to 400,000 people? 70,000, you know we got 70,000 teaching assistants in the UAW now?
Right.
70,000. We keep talking about this convention. There's 70,000 teaching assistants. There are 142,000.
We keep talking about
this convention.
Hello?
Yeah, well.
Sorry about that. I hit my button by mistake on the computer.
All right, what I'm saying is about 142,000 Detroit 3 auto workers. You got 70,000 teaching assistants. I don't know how many casino workers we have. I don't know how many public employees we have. And all the dialogue that I see on the internet pages that I look at every day is the people who are talking don't think there's anybody else in the goddamn union except those people who are working in Detroit 3.
Well, we're a minority now, aren't we?
40,000 people out of what, 617,000?
Well, how many manufacturers?
We are a marginal minority. The auto workers in the plants and the suppliers, there are 900,000 people, according to the Bureau of Labor Statistics, who populate the automobile industry. Now, that includes Toyota, Honda, GM, Ford. There are 942,000 people. Now, of those 942,000, there are about 340,000 who actually work in the auto plants. I'm talking about all the auto plants in America, union or non-union. And out of that, there are 600,000 who work in supplier plants. So the people who make the parts that comes into our assembly plants, there are twice as many of them as the people who work in the plants. If you don't understand what you're talking about, the world we are talking about is marginally 950,000 people are involved in the motor vehicle industry in the United States of America. Forget union or non-union for a minute. Of those 942,000, there are approximately 340,000 who actually work in the car plants, and twice as many people who are feeding parts to the supplier plants, to the car plants. Now, the UAW has had marginal success in organizing some small suppliers because they negotiate neutrality agreements, and you may or may not know what the hell those are. It doesn't matter at this point. They negotiate neutrality agreements. The company welcomes them in, and the people work like slaves in a cotton field for them. So you've got just under you got 940,000 people in a motor vehicle industry in this society, with a third of them who are working in the plants, and those are the people we're talking to on this show, whether they be Honda or whether they be GM, it doesn't really matter. And if you're going to talk on this show about the auto industry, that's the context you have to talk about. The subtext is these war stories. So the context is 942,000 people who make motor vehicles in our society. Stop right there. Not where do they go, what are they, it doesn't really matter. Not who's the biggest manufacturer, not any of that. We're talking about workers here. The UAW has had some marginal success in small suppliers through this despicable document called the Neutrality Agreement. And we'll let that go for the time being. So now you got Mary Barra who said, we're not going to make cars anymore. Well, then what happens to that figure of there are 942,000 people in the motor vehicle industry? If you're not going to make the Sonic, if you're not going to make the Cruze, if you're not going to make the Impala, then that number comes down. It's not the same as we're going to keep making those cars and bring robots into plants so there are going to be less people needed. They're just whacking that manufacturing capacity. So there just ain't going to be those people that built those things. So the purpose of a show like this is, so what are we doing to help people understand what's going on in their world? Not much. Never mind a goddamn newspaper article about this or that. We need to talk about this industry and then the part of this industry that is organized by the UAW, which is all of our favorite subjects, which is the unionized workers in Detroit 3. All right, we got 142,000 people out of 342,000 people. We're only one-third of the people who are making motor vehicles in this society. Why do we keep talking about we mean anything to anybody?
Well, we're the show's going to 8:30 tonight. I got something else I want to ask you about real quick. Chrysler's going to spin off their parts.
Yeah, they're going to sell off a bunch of their parts manufacturing. It goes back to General Motors in the mid-1980s when General Motors decided we have a company of 26 divisions AC Spark Plug, Delco Radio, Fisher Body. We made all of our parts and pieces. That's called vertical integration. General Motors decided in 1984 they were going to stop being vertically integrated and outsource all their parts. Okay, so we did that. And I'll just use the one word. Delphi is an example of that. It's not where they all went, but Delphi is an example of that. So we went from 26 divisions to 5 car groups that were basically simply assembly operations that made nothing. Yes, I understand we had some stamping plans. So that now Mary Barra decides we're not going to make 3 cars. So that's going to shrink the footprint. Okay. Chrysler, on the other hand, has decided they're going to outsource a lot of their transmission work. They don't want to make it anymore. And it's a smart business move. Why should he bother? Let somebody else pay the health care, the wages, and the retirement benefits of people. We don't need to do that in today's modern world. So, yeah, you're right, Scott. 3 days ago, Chrysler announced they were getting out of the powertrain manufacturing business.
Marelli, right? Marelli?
They keep shrinking their footprint down to nothing but assembly plants. I was talking to a guy for 3 hours today. I said the new facility at the Flint truck plant could well wind up being nothing but temporary workers in that plant.
It seems.
And I think that the 4th of July shutdown, they're going to populate the old truck plant and bring all the temps in to see if that works for them. That way they don't have any long-term obligation to these people. You got language in the contract that says temporaries can be temps for 5 years. And then we can take the dumb shits. If they do work themselves up to, let's say, $20 an hour, we can put them in the Tier 2 classification. They can take an $8 an hour pay cut, right? And then we got them for 8 years, working back through that progression to get where they were 8 years ago.
Right.
Because the people down in Local 12 who've been being recently, a lot of them converted to Tier 2, have taken $5 an hour pay cuts to become Tier 2s. Now, how much insanity do you want in a workplace?
That's about it. I mean, I don't see them bringing a whole bunch of temps in while we're off, but I'm not saying it could happen.
Now, what I'm saying is, my prognostication is that the plants of the future for the Detroit 3 will all be temporary workers. All they got to do is get rid of you, Shingelecker, and Mattis.
Right. Which most
and I think there's going to be a huge incentive to retirement coming in this next contract.
And I agree with that.
There are approximately 31,000 of you out of 52,000 who work in GM right now who are still in a defined benefit pension plan. They've got to kill you all off. Not for the sake of killing you off, because if they do and they can do an actuarial calculation as to using insurance companies' life calculations, that all the money left over in the pension funds, $57 billion, just simply goes back to GM. So pay, give you guys, hell, give you all $100,000. What's what's 30,000 times $100,000? I don't know. I don't have a calculator here. So what? Give it to you. Get your asses the hell out of there. Now they have made big money. Because whatever's left over the pension plan, they just take.
Right. Well,
now you got to look at the big picture here. Because getting rid of you, putting temps in a new plant, that's all one and the same thing. They want temporary workers that only have to be represented on two things under the National Labor Relations Act. They don't have any entitlement to grievance procedure representation for 5 years under the contract. Now, what do we do with your shop committee? What do we do with your chairman? Hell, we buy them off. We tell them to go to work center and go to sleep.
Right.
Because we need them there to exert their power to control the workforce to do what management wants them to do, because in the 2015 agreement, it says that the plant manager, the chairman, and or their representatives have the responsibility for efficiency and behavior of the workers. That's a direct violation of the language of paragraph 8. A chairman is responsible for my efficiency and behavior. I'll shoot that son of a bitch first.
Right.
That's black letter print in the contract today. An ignorant, self-serving political hack is in charge of my efficiency and behavior. It's not reflected
right
in his oath of office, but it's reflected in the contract today. That's a lawsuit.
Right.
That's a lawsuit. It's come that far now. That's how arrogant the UAW has been manipulated into being by the corporation. A chairman. A chairman doesn't know what the hell efficiency. The chairman's responsibility is if that assembly line is not producing first-time quality every time, he should be writing a grievance every night at the end of production that we only produced 82% first-time quality and charging management with failure to do their job. That's
they don't
want to
fight with their bed partner, Dick.
I'm just saying that's what the chairman ought to be doing. I'm not going to argue whether they should or not. That's what, if he's in charge now, and he is with the ratification of that contract, he's responsible with the plant manager. 2 men in a closet trying to make a baby. There's a physiological impossibility for you, Paul. But it's there in the contract. What morons would write language like that? And what idiots would approve it?
Fools in love,
right,
Dick.
Right.
Well, I've used that little metaphor, 2 men in a closet making babies, for joint programs for many years. But my point is this. The language says that the plant manager, the chairman and or their representatives are responsible for the efficiency and behavior of employees. What that means to me is at the end of every day, the chairman goes to the plant manager's office and says, how many did you build? How many did you ship? How many were first-time quality? And if it wasn't 100%, you can take that GMS bullshit and flush it down the toilet. It's nonsense. You don't need GMS to make a perfect car every time.
Correct. 30 seconds to go.
Okay.
Good night, everyone.
What's that? All right.
Oh, we're done.
So
all right, good night.
Yeah. All right. I guess good night, Dick. Good night, Jim. Good night, Paul.
Good night,
Marty was, I think, was listening.
Good night, Scott.
Good night, Jim.
Hey, Donnie. Good night, Donnie. Hey, Donnie.
Yeah. Okay. I'm sick. Show for the toilet. Good show, guys. Good night. Good night, Scott.
All right, good night.
Good night.